Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com.
This is TWiG, This Week in Google, episode 106, recorded August 3rd, 2011. We're feeling lucky. This Week in Google is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your new account for 6 months, go to Squarespace.com and use the offer code TWIG8. And by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. It's time for TWiG, This Week in Google, the show that covers Google, the cloud, and pretty much everything going on the internet. I am not Leo Laporte. He is actually awaiting rejection from jury duty. He said he's actually twiddling his thumbs, the poor guy. But I'm filling in for him. Happy to be here. Joining us, as always, the regulars. Glad to have Gina Trapani from SmarterWare.org. How's it going, Gina?
Howdy. It's going great. Good to see you, Tom.
Good to see you, too. And Jeff Jarvis, BuzzMachine.com. How you doing, Jeff?
I'm pink as always. I'm going to figure out this damn camera thing, but I haven't figured it out.
Believe us, Jeff is in the pink. We're very happy also to be joined by Douglas Edwards, former Googler and author of the book I'm Feeling Lucky, The Confessions of Google Employee Number 59. Welcome, Doug.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I was thrown into this at the last minute, so I'm ill-prepared. Hoping Gina and Jeff can save me. In talking to you, Doug, but employee number 59, just to get us started, explain where that fit in. What was that like? What were you doing when you started at Google?
Well, I have been working for the San Jose Mercury News for 7.5 years and was doing brand management for online products for them when I left and came to Google, expecting that it would be different from the Mercury News, which is a 150-year-old Knight Ridder corporate entity. And so I showed up at Google for the interview, and of course, Sergey Brin interviewed me and was wearing his roller skates and his hockey shorts and his hockey t-shirt and had already come in from playing outside. Didn't bother to take a shower first, which I appreciated. And, it was a completely different feel from the interview on. The questions he asked and then the experience of actually joining the company was quite different from what I had expected, even knowing that in Silicon Valley it was going to be different from what I had left.
And so the book itself is it a tell-all of all the secrets behind Google and what makes them so fantastically successful?
Or it's not all. Yeah. It's a tell-some.
Yeah. It's a tell-some. I like that.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a history of the company in terms of the major decisions that they made around certain product launches. But more than that, it's my tale of how it felt to be part of Google when it was fewer than 60 people. And it's, it is hard to explain just talking about it, but it was a very unusual place to be in terms of the energy level of the people who were there, what they were trying to accomplish. Certainly the personalities of the founders and the other engineers made it unique in my experience. And it was just my attempt to capture in words how that felt, which you had to kind of have been there to really experience.
You started there in 1999 when you could probably all fit in one picture. And then you left in 2005 when the place was gargantuan. What was it like when you left? Did you feel like you were jumping ship too early? Did you feel like it was the right time? And why did you leave?
Well, it was certainly the right time for me. And there were a confluence of different trends that happened to come together at that point in time. I'd already been there for more than 5 years. And so 5 years of working startup hours started to take a toll on me. And I had 3 children at home that I hadn't seen all that much of and decided I would like to see more of. But also the corporate culture was shifting. My boss, who had been there from the beginning, also left at the end of 2004. And she and I were very simpatico. And when she left, I was going to be reorganized into a different part of the company that was a lot more metrics driven and less, I don't want to say less fun, but certainly less focused on the things that I enjoyed doing from a brand management standpoint. So between that and the time commitment and the fact that Google had gone public and because of the shares I own, I no longer had the burning urgency or need to generate a paycheck every month. It was it seemed like a good time to make a transition out.
Have you sold your shares?
I sold most of them, yes.
You did?
Probably earlier than I should have, but yeah. for me it was like it was a simple equation. I mean, I having known Larry and Sergey as the kind of guys who like to go helicopter skiing and take unreasonable risks, I decided it was probably a good idea to take the bird in the hand instead of
Didn't you give a book talk at the Plex like 2 weeks ago?
I did, yeah.
How's the reaction been to the book from inside?
You know, Google has been great all the way through this. They've really helped me out in terms of providing access to current Google staff. And a lot of the people I worked with are still there, and I wanted to talk to them. And Google could have made it very difficult for me. They could have said, no, we're not going to provide you access to these people. Or, because of the non-disclosure agreement I signed as an employee, they could have said, you can't write about it at all.
Sure.
And they didn't do any of that. So I was really quite happy. And then the reaction, for the most part, from the people I've talked to, has been very positive. You know, they did invite me back on campus to give a kind of a Google talk. And so, the reaction has been much better than I actually anticipated.
I love that the book is... Oh, I'm sorry, Tom.
No, go ahead.
Oh, sorry, Jeff. I was going to say, I really enjoyed the book. I like the conversational tone. You kind of come at it as like this, kind of regular guy. And you imagine that the first 60 employees of Google were sort of 20-something, just graduated engineers, but you were 41, I think, at the time when you started, and yep. You were marketing. So you were kind of coming at it from like, hey, I've been covering all these startups. I wanted to find the next big thing, and I wound up at Google. And the title, I'm Feeling Lucky, was there some irony there that this just sort of happened by chance from some of the anecdotes that you tell? It sounds that way.
I wish I could claim, this incredible foresight in picking Google among all of the startups that I talked to. But it really just kind of worked out that they were the ones who offered me the job that seemed most interesting. And, I had talked to Yahoo and they offered me a position, but it just didn't feel...
You lucky?
I already felt in 1999 like the moment had passed. Yahoo was clearly a very large company, and I really wanted to get in on a small company. And I found out that the reason they were even hiring marketing people is because somebody on the board had told them that you need some marketing people. You need somebody to do the stuff that isn't engineering. All that stuff you don't want to do, you need some people in the company to do that. So they went out basically and said, okay, we'll get some marketing people. But they didn't really have a clear idea of what marketing people did or should do for Google. And that was a little confusing for me when I showed up and there was no job description and no clear expectations about what my job would be.
This is a personal question because I come from your two last worlds, working around the internet and tech now, but still in newspapers. Speaking of feeling lucky to be out of the Titanic, what was the contrast like then? And I mean, how do you feel now seeing your old ship with just its mast above the water versus what you did next?
Well, I still subscribe to both the Mercury News and the New York Times. And, I enjoy very much getting a print paper delivered in my driveway every morning, even if I have to dig it out of the bushes sometimes. But, even at the end of 99, it was clear to me, and part of the reason I left the Merc was that they really were struggling to understand this new internet world. And I thought, well, I'll go off, I'll join a startup. It'll probably go out of business in 12 months, and then I'll come back to corporate newspapers, and I'll be the in-house internet guy. I'll have gained my stripes. I'll have some expertise in what it's like to be at an internet startup, and then I can bring that back to the newspaper and leverage that into some kind of position. I didn't realize that the newspapers would be gone in 12 months. That was pretty surprising how quickly things turned south. But, you know, I could see, I mean, Knight Ridder in particular was really focused on protecting their print classified product because it was just such an enormously, you know, high margin business. And so everything they did online was geared towards getting people to buy ads in the classified section of the Mercury News. And so that did not feel like an ultimately winning strategy to me. And I decided I probably needed to try something else.
Now, did that scare you at all that Google and to this day still relies entirely on one source of income? Advertising on search is their big cash cow, similar to the position the newspapers were in. Their big cash cow is classifieds.
Yeah, you know, it's never a good thing to have all of your eggs in one basket, I think. But the difference is that Google isn't sitting still, you know, trying to protect online advertising. They're constantly innovating within the advertising itself. They're expanding into you know, video ads and brand-based ads and ad networks. And, you know, there's an advertising is a very large field, and I think they've diversified quite a bit within the advertising space, whereas Knight Ridder, you know, had a hard time, I think, at least from my perspective, in expanding beyond just the print version of classified. They tried a lot of things online, but they were not really successful. And I think ultimately it was because they kept bringing the classified model from newspapers to the online space.
Well, I have to say, having worked in an industry, I worked in television as the web guy, it is really hard to turn that boat. You know, it's really hard to get people to understand how a new system works and how it can work for them because they have their own preconceived notions. Was that a relief working at Google, or did you start to run in as it got bigger to some of those same sorts of situations?
No, you know, it was such a you know, reversal of what I had been living. You know, I at the Merck, they had a separate database for classified ads, for print, for display ads. They had a database for the newspaper, you know, for the editorial. They had a circulation database, none of which talked to each other. There was no, you know, interaction among the different technologies within the company. And I went to Google, and everything was, you know, built from the ground up, and it all worked together. There were none of these legacy issues. You didn't have to worry about whether something new would work with something old. Because if there were ever a problem, it was all online. They could just fix it in the back end, and the user would experience it as if it were, you know, a continuously upgraded product. So, but, you know, I came to Google thinking, all right, I'm older than these kids, right? I'm 41. I've had 20 plus years experience in marketing, and I'll come in and I'll show them how this is done. You know? And that's not exactly how they viewed my position in the company. So, you know, that that took a little getting used to, the idea that everything that I knew to be true was actually wrong, and that I needed to start from scratch and unlearn, not just, you know, start from zero, but actually go back and unlearn all of the things that I thought were absolutes in marketing.
So you've mentioned that you waited 6 years to write the book, and you kind of said in one of the interviews that you finally realized you had to. Take me through that. Why did you wait so long, and why did you have to?
Well, when I left Google, I immediately thought, oh, I'll write a book about my experience. And so then I said, well, you know, I was at Google. I want to do something non-traditional. I'll just blog my experience. And I set up that Zoogler's blog back in 2005 and, you know, was just pouring a lot of stories into it and so forth. And it started to feel like work, you know, and when I would take a week off, you know, and not post anything, people would be emailing me, when are you going to post again? What, you know, what's going on? Are you abandoning this? And it, you know, the pressure to continuously update it started to become a little annoying. So I said, all right, you know what, I'm just going to quit. I'm just going to give it up and just move on with life. And I went on and did some other things. But, you know, everywhere I looked, Google was a presence. You know, online, certainly it's everywhere, but in TV, in print, on the radio. And every time I heard Google mentioned, you know, this little ding would go off in my head. And I'm like, oh, yeah, remember the story behind that and how we got to that space? Or somebody would be, you know, giving some lengthy explanation from an outside perspective of what Google was about. And I'd say, well, that's not exactly accurate. So I finally decided, well, if you're going to get this out of your head, I had to write it down. And the only way to get it done was to write it down. So I started working on the book about 2.5 years ago. And if I had known how long it was going to take, I certainly would not have embarked on the journey. It was just a lot of interviewing of both current Googlers and ex-Googlers, a lot of trying to recreate the timeline of things that happened. And finally, you know, when I had written over 500 pages and my editors started choking on it and said, you know, that's probably enough for now. You know, they cut it down by 100. They probably should have cut it down by 150. But, you know, I think they wanted to actually have it see the light of day at some point in this century.
So I'm asking in the chat room what they want to know. And the first question up is, what do you think of Google Plus?
Do you have an account?
Of course. Yeah, I do like Google Plus. And, you know, I've been A-B testing it with Facebook. You know, I'll post something on Facebook and then I'll post. And I've had a Facebook account for a long time, a personal one. And then I'll post something on Google Plus and see where I get more reaction or how quickly I hear from people. I mean, the thing that's amazing to me, though, is that not so much Facebook, but Twitter, you know, which I had set up an early account on Twitter, a personal account, and never used it. And, you know, I mean, I understand it's very valuable to a lot of people. But for me personally, I didn't need it. And then when I wrote the book, I said, OK, I'll set up one to talk about the book and Google issues. And, you know, over a period of a few months, I built up, I think, you know, 300 or 400 Twitter followers. And, you know, that seemed like a fair number of people. I was on Google Plus for a week and I had 1,500 followers, you know, people I didn't know from all over the world. And I'm like, why? Why are these people signing up to follow me on Google Plus? But just the difference in the scale really impressed me, considering how few people, I mean, 20 million people are on Google Plus, but compared to Facebook, it's not that many. So,
I've
been impressed with, what they've accomplished so far.
You're A-B testing Facebook versus Google Plus, which is funny because you said you had to unlearn everything. And you emphasize in the book how Google is such a data-driven company. And I think that question of, like, what do you think of Google Plus is kind of a bigger question of, do you think that a company that's mastered this data-driven algorithmic approach toward indexing content has the capacity to do the same for people?
Yeah, this is the big challenge for Google, because I think they will continue to develop great technologies to plug into Google Plus. But the human intelligence that goes along with it, that Facebook seems to have really understood what people are looking for in a social network, I'm not convinced Google is going to be as quick to grasp that. You know, I'm hoping that they're going to bring some people into the company who are, you know, as I said in one interview, a little more irrational, you know, like normal people, and not just completely driven by metrics and logic and, you know, coding hygiene and this is the way you do things, because that's not the way people operate in the real world. People do things that don't seem all that logical on the surface, but make perfect sense to them. So I'd like to see Google bring in some of those folks, and possibly the impact of that would be to have a better social networking product.
Yeah, that you told a story earlier in the book about how you were having a conversation with Larry, I think it was, and you know you had lost an argument and you were going back to kind of make amends, and you said, you know, looking back, I know more often than not you've been right, so I just wanted to let you know that I knew that. And he looked at you and said, well, when have we been wrong? And not in an offended way, but in a way that he wanted to, you know, kind of in a robotic way. Like,
it just kind of blew me away, right? You know what I mean? You said, you know, I'm doing this, we can all get along, and I appreciate how smart you are and everything. And
you know. You were appealing to his emotion, and he wanted more signals for his internal algorithm. And I thought that was very, very telling.
Yeah, he was really puzzled that anybody would think that he had actually been wrong about anything, because as far as he could tell, he'd never been wrong about anything. Everything was clearly moving exactly the way it should be.
Well, and I get the sense it's not out of pride, but out of a surety. Like, we have followed the algorithm, and the algorithm works. So point out the error in my code.
Exactly.
The certainty in the data.
I've written a good program here. You show me where it's flawed. I mean, the output is exactly what I expected and you know, desired. So I don't see where there's any problem with it.
One of the criticisms I hear the most often about Google these days, anyway, is that they don't have a good customer service presence, that it's hard to get an answer from somebody. It's hard to get, you know, some response when you have a problem. Do you think that has its roots in that engineering basis of it? They seem to be trying to get better at that. They've been doing a lot with Google Plus at public outreach, but it's one of the areas that they need to catch up.
I talk about that, you know, at length in the book, in terms of, I was in charge of customer service because clearly customer service was not engineering, so it must be marketing. So, you know, I I was handed, you know, here, you do customer
that's
service,
a little, yeah, which, right.
You know, well, but that is very Zappos. That's very Zappos, Doug, right? Yeah. I mean, customer service is the new marketing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's not the way they looked at it. They looked at it as it is a non-engineering function. So anything that is non-engineering, you don't want to deal with. And, you know, there was one guy using Microsoft Outlook to respond to thousands, you know, tens of thousands of users, and that quickly became overwhelming.
Sure.
But Larian, you know, so we would fall behind, and we'd have these queues filled of email comments from people who, you know, we were trying to get back to within 24 hours. And what, you know, when I went to Larry and Saria and complained, I said, you know, we need more people to deal with customer service. And they said, well, we shouldn't even be answering customer service emails, because if they're calling to compliment us, they already love us. So we don't need to send them a note, you know, back. They already like us. So mission accomplished. Or if they're calling to complain, you know, if there's a technical issue, then it's far better to take our resources and allocate them to solving the problem that they've identified rather than emailing them back to tell them, oh, we're going to work on that problem for you. So, you know, it was a resource allocation question. So they never saw any need to respond to email. And in fact, at one point they suggested just writing a program that would randomly generate responses and send them out. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, that response is going to be just fine. You know, so
efficiency above all.
Yeah,
they should, very efficient thing. I guess you have to pitch it as any customer service email is a search query. And how are we going to respond to that?
Yeah. Well, they didn't buy that.
They just,
you know, and, you know, Sheryl Sandberg, who went off to Facebook as COO, you know, she talked about trying to respond to queries at Facebook. And she ultimately came to the same conclusion that Larry and Sergey did, I think, that it doesn't make sense to answer every email that somebody sends to you. It's just not efficient. You know, it's too easy for people to vent themselves through email. And the question of whether or not all emails are equally important and urgent is one I think, you know, companies have to deal with.
Yeah, well, especially when you're getting them at that level. The risk you run, though, is that you end up with these people ranting in public because they feel slighted, whether it's justified or not, and you may or may not suffer from the fallout from that.
Yeah, I mean, if there's critical mass of people complaining about one feature or, you know, an inability to use the service, then clearly you have a real problem, and you need to address it. And certainly some of the stuff that came up around privacy, I think, that in particular is an area where you do need to be very responsive, or you can start getting a very bad vibe spreading about your product.
Before we wrap up, Gina, any more follow-up questions?
I have to say that when I read the beginning of the book about your interview with Google, when Sergey said to you, I'm going to go to the candy machine now and I'm going to give you 5 minutes to think about something really complex and I expect you to explain it to me for an hour when I return, I spent a long time thinking about what I would be explaining to him. And I've heard that Google interviews are scary. That sounded really scary, even though it was, in the day.
It was a tough one because, you know, he wanted me to tell him something he didn't already know so that he wouldn't be wasting his time if they didn't hire me. At least he'd get some knowledge out of it. And I didn't know. I just met him. I had no idea what he knew. And,
right.
You know, so Cindy McCaffrey, who was head of marketing PR, said, you know, I mean, he's interested in everything, so you can talk about anything. It doesn't have to be related to technology. So that gave me a little leeway.
Thanks. Obviously, you nailed it.
Yeah, I think Cindy probably felt like I did okay. I'm not sure Sergey, agreed, but he knew that he needed some marketing people, and Cindy said hire him, so I think he went along.
He didn't get in the way.
Yeah.
So the other question the chat room wants to know is what kind of phone do you use?
I have an iPhone version of 3GS. Yeah, although my son, is all about the Droid, and he's very happy with his. So we're sort of a mixed family when it comes to technology.
So I'm curious because, you know, here you are head of marketing, the company that grew to be huge, the fastest growing brand in the world with no marketing, and having come from an industry based on marketing. Now that Google has the Android and is starting to market some products, how do you think they're doing?
I can't say that I have a real solid sense of Android as a brand. You know, I mean, it feels more like the old, you know, Intel Inside kind of things, you know, where it's an ingredient. And so I don't have I'm aware of Android as a presence in the market, but it seems kind of fractured to me. I don't have a very concrete sense, whereas with Apple, you always know exactly what you're what you're looking at, which is basically Steve Jobs' vision, you know, implemented in hardware and software. And with Android, it feels a lot more amorphous to me. So I can't say that I have a strong sense of Android as a brand, although, you know, if I do associate any qualities with it, it's that it's, you know, fast and very innovative and continuing to evolve. So, you know, I'd say that it's, you know, it's still got some room to grow as a marketing concept.
That's all right. Any more questions before we let Doug go?
Thank you for coming on the show. It was great to have you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Congrats on the book.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
We've been looking forward to this.
Doug is the author of I'm Feeling Lucky, The Confessions of Google Employee, number 59, available bookstores everywhere. Easily found online. Do a search on Google. It'll come up with it. Thank you, Doug. We really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us.
All right, my pleasure.
Thanks, Doug.
I really like the Zoogler's site, too. I'm going to check that out. I know you said you need to post more on it, but that's the ex-Googlers reminiscing. So check that out as well. xooglers.blogspot.com.
Well, related news in the list here, Tom, is that Google got rid of its Google Friends newsletter.
What was the Google Friends newsletter?
It was an early newsletter of people talking to maybe Doug's still on. Maybe he can tell us what it was in the earliest days.
Yeah, Doug's you're still there.
I'm still there. Larry started that back when they were at Stanford, and it would be, you know, just him talking about new machines that they bought, or, you know, that they were going to Burning Man or whatever. And so, you know, don't bother sending him an email. Not that he would have answered it anyway, but that became one of my responsibilities. I had to start writing the Google Friends newsletter, and it was, you know, supposed to be a monthly. I think we ultimately went to bi-monthly with updates about all the Google products, and it went to any user who signed up for it and who was interested in you know, learning more about Google. So it was a real pain to write, too, because, you know, Larry and Sergey always like to have a red pen on it, and they make a lot of changes.
Was anyone subscribed, Jeff? Were you subscribed to it?
No, I wasn't. I didn't know about it until it died.
Yeah, no, I know. Me, too. And you wrote a book about Google. So I wonder if Leo was subscribed. I hadn't heard of it until it died, and then I said, oh.
Yeah, there so much for that. There were 30,000 subscribers back in, you know, 2001, 2002. So, I mean, it had, you know,
that's
a fair
size.
Readership.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I'm sure it grew quite a bit since then.
Well, they claim the number of subscribers has remained flat because they have so many other ways of communicating, the official Google blog, Twitter, and such. So they've concluded the format is no longer the best way to get the word out.
Yeah. Well, the blog, you know, the launch of the blog, that was a really harrowing experience. That happened during the quiet period and right before the IPO. And so the original Google blog, you know, there were questions about whether we could even do that. But ultimately, we, you know, as Google often did, pushed ahead without too much fear of legal ramifications.
Full speed ahead.
Yeah. That's so crazy. Can't have a company blog. I mean, that seems like, you know, now in this day and age, it's like...
Well, it was seen as promoting the fact that we hadn't done it previously, that we were launching a new communication vehicle during the quiet period, was one that raised some eyebrows. So it wasn't that we couldn't do a blog. I mean, we could certainly do it after the IPO. And we owned Blogger. I mean, we had bought Pyra Labs, which was Blogger. So we were using our own technology to do it. But, you know, so the first posts were things like Charlie Ayer's fried chicken recipe. Is rather non-controversial, unlikely to inflate the stock artificially.
That fried chicken recipe was pretty good.
It was damn good.
You never know. That could have an influence.
That recipe from Elvis Presley's personal chef.
Yeah.
And so it was the same fried chicken Elvis and the Colonel used to eat.
All right. Well, we will let you go now, Doug. But thanks again so much for talking to us. Really appreciate
it. Take care.
We got to take a break before we get into the news and thank our sponsor, Squarespace. It's squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. Easy-to-use UI for creating and managing a website, optimized for beginners and CSS experts. So if you don't know what CSS is, you don't need to. You can still use Squarespace. It's drag and drop. You put your modules in, you write what you want, you put it where you want on the page. It's what you see is going to be on the page. But if you do know what CSS is, you can get in there and edit the code behind the module. In fact, one of the things I like when I'm creating posts in Squarespace, you can either go in the raw HTML and edit it there and do the coding yourself, and they give you some tools that allow you to highlight and put in links easily. But if you're not, if you're in the more visual interface, you can still click a button that says, just show me the HTML really quick so I can make a small tweak and then go right back. It's really easy to flip back and forth between it. We love it. I use it for forecast. I use it for Sword and Laser. And it's easy to move into. If you're on Blogger, Movable Type, Typepad, WordPress, you can export your data into Squarespace and try it out. In fact, you can try it out for free thanks to the fact that you're watching Twig. See if you like it. And if you don't like it, you can export your data right back out again. Squarespace doesn't want to lock you in. They're pretty sure you're going to like it. So they're willing to swear by data portability. Try it out right now. You don't need a credit card or anything. Just you can go start any site you want. You can throw up iwasemployee60.squarespace.com right now. No credit card needed. And if you decide to purchase the Squarespace service after the free trial, use the offer code. What is our offer code? I think it's Twig. Twig8. Because of August. Twig8, and you get 10% off for 6 months. That's squarespace.com. Use the offer code Twig8, and we thank Squarespace for their support of This Week in Google. So Google's been on a spending spree. They went and bought themselves, 1,030 patents from IBM.
IBM. It's, by the way, if you haven't listened to it, this week's or the latest online podcast from This American Life.
Oh, yeah, that's fantastic.
Called When Patents Attack. Everybody, listen to it. It's just amazing. And it puts Nathan Myhrvold in his right spot. But it also shows mainly the insanity of this, of the billions of dollars that are spent on patents, not to increase invention, not to increase production, but only to defend oneself. And this is exactly what Google did. It bought itself some hardened underwear.
Yeah, because they're patent poor is the way they're determined. And I think they have taken the attitude that we don't really need patents. We feel like we can be open and we want to share and we'll patent what we really need to. But it turns out it doesn't matter whether you feel you need patents or not. You need them because it's the only way to defend yourself.
Gina, have you ever gotten a patent?
No, I haven't.
Talk to me about your attitude about that in terms of if you invent something, why would you consider it? Why wouldn't you? What would your thought? Because I know you have invented things and probably you just don't think that way.
I don't think that way. I'm just so disgusted with the whole patent system that I would hate to do it. And honestly, all of my projects have been, either side personal projects that weren't, a huge business, or I've been working for someone else who took care of that kind of thing. So it really hasn't come up for me seriously. But I am completely disgusted with the whole system. And I'm kind of a little small part of me hopes that Google is going to try to change the system. Because the next story in our roundup is about how Google is hiring an IP expert from the FTC.
Suzanne Michelle.
Yeah, who wrote a paper about how bad the patent system is and ways to improve it. So that was an interesting hire. So I wonder if they're just bulking up their patents and then maybe they're trying to acquire enough to then, change the way that try to make a change or make proposals about how the patent system is and, some improvements that they need that leverage, right? They need to own a bunch of patents in order to make a move or try to change the way it works. I don't know how they would do it. I hope that they do. I'm not very articulate about it.
I think Eric Schmidt's job right now is to do this kind of stuff, to lobby for this kind of stuff in Washington, among many other things, obviously. So I know that they have that effort beginning. But buying up the patents and then getting an intellectual property expert like Suzanne Michelle she was one of the FTC's top intellectual property officials, leaving her post to go work at Google implies that they may be going after it from the other end. 1,000 patents at once, that's huge. There's also another patent pile, I can't remember who it's from, that Samsung, Apple, and Google are all bidding on. So Google has finally changed their minds. Oh, it's Nortel, thank you. I think they had the same attitude you did, Gina, which was, I don't really want to play this game. I don't need to play this game. And they've gotten big enough, they've realized, well, now Oracle's coming after us. All of the Android phones are now under all of these patent lawsuits from various areas. We need to get in there. Now, the way they would normally get in there, and this is what was described in the This American Life episode so well, is to go and fight fire with fire. You threaten to sue somebody to keep them from suing you, or if they do sue you, you file countersuit so that you can force a settlement. But Gina, I feel like what you're saying is you're hoping that they would do something different, where they would actually try to change the system. Could they change it from within that way? Could they use a huge pile of patents to just stop lawsuits in general somehow?
I don't know. Maybe they could. I would like to see them try. I mean, what are some other big things that Google's tried to change? They tried to change a little bit the way the mobile industry works and the way that mobile phones are sold to consumers and contracts and all those things. That didn't go so well. So I don't know. I don't know if this hire is interesting. It's interesting that her responsibilities are not clear. She's been at the FTC for 11 years. Very interesting. So I would like to see them try to change, because I really think that at this point, patents do not protect innovation. They stifle it. And right. We have companies spending so much money on lawyers. Like, lawyers make tons of money, and companies have to, you know, put resources toward, instead of innovating, building new things, fighting these stupid battles. So I would love to see Google take on the patent situation, because I really think it's in a bad place and just does not serve the technology industry well at all.
Do you feel like there should be patents, either one of you? Leo has gone on record, you know, as recently as this week's tweet, saying he doesn't think there should be software patents at all.
Gina, you first.
I tend toward saying no. Not the way that they are now. And honestly, I haven't thought this through fully, so I'm afraid I'm going to say something sounding really dumb. But I really think that most great ideas are just, you know, we're all kind of standing on the shoulders of giants, right? So we're all going to build upon things that other people have done, every single kind of technology. And I don't think that it serves anyone well to say, you know, this is mine. No one else can do anything with it. I mean, I know there has to be some sort of protection in place, just not what we have now. There's a lot of room for improvement.
Yeah, I keep on going back and forth, Tom, on this. I think that because I've had the same battle with myself about other IP, about copyright as well. Mm-hmm. I guess the question on patents is that the whole raison d'etre for patents is that it was supposed to, as Gina just said, encourage innovation by having people be more open than not, because it gave them a path to openness that protected what they did, right? Well, it's clearly not working that way. Right? It's stifling innovation. It's making people scared. It's stopping things. So the rationale behind patents is not being served by patents. Now, part of that is the absolute inanity of the patent system. If we had a decent patent system, would that be better? Was that a solution? I don't know, but we all know the patent system now is insane. On the This American Life show, they highlight the patent recently issued for toast, you know, which is just an absurd mockery of the whole system using the system itself. And some of the patents they talk about on the show are so broad as to cover absolutely everything, and there are, you know, 1,000 patents just like that patent. They can't even issue patents on top of patents, let alone on top of real prior art. All right, but so let's say the system worked. Let's say that they actually got down to decent patents that really were real. Would that improve innovation? I think in a world that moves as fast as ours does today, it wouldn't, because the patent system, no matter how fast it could be, will be way behind the innovation that's already occurring. And when you see something neat, what do we all do? You learn from it. You copy it. You build on the shoulders of giants, as Gina said. So I'm the same as Gina. I'm afraid to say anything definitive because I'm afraid of being stupid about it. But I am seeing that this needs a very different way to think.
Yeah, I guess I just won't be afraid to be stupid. I don't think there doesn't need to be patents. I think there is room for patent law. But I think patents, and I'll throw in copyrights in there as well, need to be ripped up and started over with the aim of what you're saying. Where they actually can be demonstrated to encourage innovation, then we should have the law. Because, like you said, the idea was I want protection for my idea so that if I start putting it out there, I don't just get ripped off by somebody else and it gets taken away from me. In software, the reason I think a lot of people say we just shouldn't have patents is rarely do you see software patents protecting true innovation, something entirely new. You see them protecting a little variation. The algorithm is broken for determining what is patentable, and that needs to be absolutely overhauled. And I think in that process, maybe we can discover whether software actually is patentable or not. I mean, I tend to favor the Free Software Foundation perspective a little bit, that I should be able to write whatever software I want, run whatever software I want on my devices, and software, you know, should be open and free, because it's just the thing that's making the device work, and the device is the thing that's patentable. But I don't, I and maybe I am being afraid of being stupid a little bit, I don't want to go so far as to say there would never be a case where software couldn't be patentable.
You know, I just wrote a piece for Wired Germany, which they nicely translated for me, that I'm hoping to sell here in the U.S., on Gutenberg as the first technology entrepreneur. And I was fascinated doing the research for it. I just loved it. But one thing I learned is it went when Gutenberg lost his business to his main investor because he didn't have the cash flow to pay up. Gutenberg had been incredibly, incredibly secretive before, very Steve Jobs-like. He operated out of three or four facilities, so no one knew the whole picture of what was going on. He wouldn't let people in. He wouldn't let them in the business, just all kinds of things. But then when he lost the business, you know what he did? He open-sourced it. He taught other people how to do it because it was his to the guys who'd stolen his, who'd taken his business. And, you know, what made more innovation happen? The closed printing press method or the open method? The answer is obvious.
Yeah, for sure. I agree. I agree with what you're saying, Jeff. I mean, I think that we have to have a path to openness and a path to innovation. And this idea that we seem to have the presumption these days that everything should be locked down, either for a long time in the case of copyright or in breadth in the case of patent, that every little thing you could possibly come up with should be locked down. Let's talk about Google Plus. Good news for Google Plus, hitting 25 million visitors, and apparently pretty sticky as well, even while it's still invite only. I mean, it's not impossible to get an invite. It's fairly permeable, but it's limited. Not everybody can just sign up for it. So that's a pretty big number. And remember, it was introduced on my birthday, June 28th. So not that long ago.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. Andrew Lipsman, Vice President of Industry Analysis at Comscore, is the one estimating the 25 million unique visitors. And you guys, you know, you talk about it every week. Developers now think Google Plus can beat Facebook. 25 million viewers. You got developers starting to talk good about it. What does it need? What needs to happen for that to work, though?
Google Plus is on the right track. It's doing really well. People love it. People are using it. I think it's great that it's had this adoption, this, you know, kind of vertical line of adoption. I tell you the truth, I don't think that it's that big a deal given Google's suite of products and the sort of brand trust that people have in Google. You know, of course it took Twitter and Facebook much longer to gain users because people didn't know who they were. That, you know, that they were unknown companies that had to build themselves up on the basis of this, you know, new product. Google Search, I mean, I think is one of the most trusted brands in at least the United States. I think we've talked about people love Gmail. And the fact that developers think that Google's going to beat Facebook, absolutely. And we've talked about the trust factor a lot on this show. I think that people, or from my perspective, our people, our audience, trust the Google brand more than Facebook. So I think Google Plus is absolutely on the right track, still really enjoying the kind of customer service that Googlers have been doing inside of Google Plus. I've circled quite a few Googlers and they're constantly discussing the product. I think that the one snag that they've got going on right now is this name issue, which they've been real quiet about, and I'm kind of really interested to hear what the outcome of this is going to be, the real names policy I'm referring to. I think that this real names policy really contradicts the don't be evil stance. I think that they need to support pseudonyms and brand names and that kind of thing. I'm hoping to see them kind of announce a resolution to that. Other than that, I think that that's a problem for a small percentage of people. Other than that, I think Google Plus is going to continue its its rise. I've been using it a lot, and it's really been taking a lot of my social media attention. I really enjoy it. I'm guaranteed to get 100 comment thread on a Google Plus post, a public post, almost every time. The engagement level is extremely, extremely high. And for the most part, there are little snags here and there. It's a great product to use. Really enjoying it. I'm feeling very bullish about it myself as a developer. I can't wait for the API to get released.
I think that's key, Gina, right? I mean, I actually found that I'm using it a little bit less. My hashtag fun of a week ago was better done on Twitter, because on Twitter, with hashtags, as I said last show, you could gather around a topic. And you can't gather around anything on Google Plus, and I find that frustrating. It's hard to kind of get a sense of what people are talking about or join in on a conversation. It bifurcates. But these are things that I agree they'll fix. But I think search, the irony to me is just so incredible, and I wish someone would explain why they came out with this product, this company, without search.
I know, it's incredible.
But, I was talking to some people. There's a
It's a field test, Jeff. That's why.
I know, but Jesus, they got the technology. There's got to be a story behind that, and I would die to know the story. I was talking to some people today from a Mozilla news project that's really quite neat that Google's involved in. And, somebody started talking about the word social in there. And it occurred to me, what the heck does social mean? Right? I can define antisocial, and social is kind of the whole rest of life. Everything is social. And I don't think that Google Plus is really about Google and social. I go back to the notion that it's about them generating signals and having more connections with us as a person. You know, in a sense, it's not about Google creating a social world for us. It's about Google trying to get more human with us. And that's what makes Google Plus to me so interesting, is that it becomes this petri dish for us people.
Mm-hmm. I find that Google Plus for me ends up being a place to ask a question and get an answer and start a conversation about your own topic, where Twitter is a place for me to throw out kind of a thought and maybe get a little reaction. But Google Plus works much better for, hey, I want to discuss this one thing. Twitter works for, like, let me just kind of throw something into the general stream of conversation. So, for instance, I used to use Twitter quite a bit for researching top fives for the show. I do top five. I'd say, what's your favorite Harry Potter movie moment? And everyone would reply me, and then I'd have to go find those at replies and page through them. Google Plus works much better for that because you get everything in one thread. But like you say, it doesn't allow you to bust out of that. So if you want to have a more wide-ranging conversation, Twitter's better for that. But it's entirely replaced Facebook for me. I don't touch Facebook anymore.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And to be fair, I didn't touch Facebook that much to begin with. But I find the few uses that I had for Facebook have been limited now to getting in touch with close friends and relatives for very particular purposes, which I probably, if they were all on Google Plus, could do on Google Plus. They're just not all over there yet.
Well, I think Gina just raised a metric for success here, is the robustness of the conversation that's caused, right? And Facebook is the lower end, the lowest end of that. Twitter is up but disjointed, and Google Plus is actually very high. It's engineered very well to do that, to the point of a fault, because, you have to mute Scoble all the time as he decides Google Plus is the next thing and dead, next thing and dead, next thing and dead.
Scoble himself admits, you just got to mute me a lot in life.
Yeah.
But do you think that Facebook is low on that list because you're followed by or commented on Google Plus by more of your audience? Like I go to Facebook because my family and friends from high school who aren't nerds are there. So the conversations I have there, they're all like, what's all this techno mumble jumble you always are talking about? But I can have a conversation about something highly technical on Google Plus, and that's our audience. So the conversation is very high quality. I mean, Facebook's features are very similar to Google Plus, and it's threaded conversations, likes and, images and links. So do you think that that's because of the people who are on G Plus or because of the tool itself?
I'm not at all sure. Yeah. I think that, there's an interesting discussion here. Fred Wilson and I got into a disagreement, which doesn't happen very often, on Twitter, and he proposed that he and I should do a debate on this topic, on the notion of real identity. And he is being rather dogmatic, I think, and I respect Fred greatly, saying that real identity doesn't matter at all, it doesn't help at all. And my argument is no. And he says that what made Facebook succeed was structured feeds and structured data. Well, I don't agree, because you could have structured the hell out of MySpace, and it was a bunch of fake people with no investment in it, and it was all crap, and it wouldn't have fixed that at all. I argue that real identity, real people, real relationships made Facebook work, and it was the secret to it. And, of course, Twitter doesn't have real identity enforced, but there's a hell of a lot of real identity there. People really use it because they want credit for what they're saying. They want a lot of things.
Yeah.
Sorry, I see I'm freezing again. And so now we get to the question of Google Plus and this and the identity that happens there. You know, after our discussion last week, Gina, I'm still in a kind of a middle ground where I understand the desire to have real identity because of what it does for the service, alongside pseudonyms, alongside perhaps some structure of approved anonymity. But I understand the desire to have a higher quality discussion around authenticity. And so I think that that's part of the thing about Facebook, ironically, is that those are the people you really know. And so you have an invested relationship with them versus on Twitter, I'll throw out a line.
Yeah. Yeah, it's right. More disposable on Twitter, definitely. All right, we got some Android news we need to get to, but I want to thank our sponsor, Netflix. If you would like to watch some streaming movies for free, go to netflix.com/twit right now. And you can get 30 days of Netflix streaming for free. Watch it on your phone. Watch it on your tablet. A ton of Android phones have it now. It's coming to more all the time. And you can watch it on your television through a Roku player, through an Apple TV, through an Xbox 360, a PS3, a Wii, and see movies in HD right there on your screen. No risk trial. Netflix.com/twit. We thank them for their support. And if you already tried Netflix or you're already using Netflix, tell others. Spread it around. Give it to your mom. Give it to your kids. Well, if your kids are out of the house. If the kids are in the house, you could just sign up for it. Netflix.com/twit. We thank them for their support of This Week in Google. So, Canalys, who does the worldwide numbers, came out with their most recent survey. Doesn't really show much of a change in the market, but Google's mobile OS is now on 48% of smartphones worldwide. Month to month, that's not that much different. But it's a steady uptick that has Android headed to 50%, and it looks like there's no stopping the rampant growth.
Makes sense. Tons of handsets out there and options. Lots of Android devices out there. It makes a lot of sense that this is activations or this is just cell phones, handsets.
Just handsets. Yeah, we're not talking about tablets, and I believe we're talking about existing market share, not sales. If I'm right.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, makes a lot of sense. Android's doing really well. Also, I hope that Google can steady the course for Android a little bit on a few items. Like, I'd like to see Google TV do a little better, although Google TV isn't included in this write up in tablets. But
did you see the news on Google TV since our last show that they have more returns than sales?
Now they've clarified that.
They have
more returns from retailers. Then they have had retailers sell. They are not being returned by the consumers who actually buy them. So they're just not selling any. It's not that they're breaking.
Well, that's good news. Yeah.
And now they're trying to sell some for $99 instead of $299, right? $249.
And you can get the Honeycomb beta on it, although you can't go back, so be careful. But it's actually fairly easy. If you find the Honeycomb beta, there's lots of places to find it online, and put it on a USB drive. You just turn your box off, plug in the USB drive, reboot, and it installs itself. It's almost too simple, because if it doesn't work, it could brick your system. There's always that chance, and you can't go back. But you don't have to get root access to do it.
And is the market hasn't launched, isn't in the Honeycomb beta yet?
You know, that's a good question. I would assume people would be talking that up if that was in there. And I've been meaning to do this to my Logitech review unit. And try it out. I've been putting it off because I want to bring it in here and do it on camera. And watch it fail spectacularly live on the stream, probably. But I still believe in Google TV as a possibility, but right now, we're just talking about Netflix. It's my Netflix box in the bedroom because I happen to have it. And, that, you know, that's the other way to get it. I've used it a couple times for HBO Go, which is one of the few ways you can get HBO Go on a television versus on a tablet or a phone.
Wait, on Google TV have HBO Go?
Yeah, through Chrome.
Oh, through Chrome. Okay,
and gotcha. They actually have a shortcut widget on the screen that takes you to HBO Go, but it just takes you to a Chrome full screen browser.
Very cool. Yeah. That's super cool. I also believe in the possibility of Google TV. I've always kind of embarrassed to admit how much I like the Google TV, the Logitech unit. I got it as part of their developer program. And I really like having a browser with Flash on my TV. You know, I mean, there are a lot of places.
Even if everyone blocks it. It's still even nice.
Well, not quite everyone. So I'm a UFC fan, and I like to watch the fights on the website, the UFC website, because you can, you know, there's a scrubber and you can replay things and whatever. So I really enjoy that, and I like picture in picture. I like being able to search Twitter. The thing is that it's laid fallow for so long, right? I mean, they've been promising the market and an upgrade. It's supposed to happen late this summer, right? So soon, maybe this month. But it's just been a really long time. So it doesn't surprise me. You know, the price was too high. It didn't impress when it first got released, and it's been a long time. So I'm really looking forward to the upgrade, which apparently will be this Honeycomb upgrade that you're talking about. It looks like I have an evening project.
I'm looking forward to the marketplace. I think that was a good question to ask, because once this thing actually is able to run some apps, I think you'll be able to make better use of it.
Definitely.
And there have been some patches that have fixed some glitchy things for me. But, you know, overall, $99 going to convince you to get one, Jeff?
It's not the money. It's the usability. You know, I think that's what I wait for and see what happens.
All right,
reasonable.
Yeah, I think that absolutely is reasonable. Google and TI, Texas Instruments, are hooking up for Ice Cream Sandwich. Looking a little farther down the line, Ice Cream Sandwich will allow developers to create apps once. And the operating system is due in the fourth quarter. Will be smart enough to figure out which type of device the app is running on and then adjust accordingly. TI will be a prominent part of the Ice Cream Sandwich rollout. What does this mean?
Got me.
This means, from what I understand, I have published an Android app, and I haven't done a whole lot of tablet development. But it basically means that Honeycomb and the core Android will merge. So as a developer, you can make an app which is smart about what is available to it, whether or not it's a tablet, whether or not it has tablet support of those different panels and the smart bar and the different things that the Ice Cream Sandwich or the tablet part of Ice Cream Sandwich makes available, which is really nice for developers, because you can build your app to sort of degrade or upgrade gracefully depending on what kind of device the person is using, whether or not it's a tablet or a phone. And Android has a lot of that right now. When you publish your app, you can say, here are the assets to use if you have a low res screen, here are the high res assets to use on a bigger screen. You know, some devices have hardware keyboards and some don't. So this just kind of continues down that path of letting apps take advantage of what's available to them on install.
So that allows TI to take the architecture they've been building for phones and be able to execute the tablet operating system and put their chips in tablets is what it seems like because of that. London-based research firm called Vision Mobile released a method of tracking openness among mobile platforms called the Open Governance Index. And according to its metrics, Android is the least open of all the supposedly open source mobile platforms. Seeing this on ReadWriteWeb, 23% openness rating. Eclipse, which is an open development platform comprised of extensible networks and tools, got the highest rating at 84%. I think, you know, a lot of people have considered this to be true already just based on the issues they've had around rollouts and access to the code. So they're comparing the Android to things like Linux, WebKit, Mozilla, Mego, Symbian. How much do you feel like this impacts you, Gina?
You know, this word open, it's just so fraught. I mean, it's the word that Google uses to sell Android, and it's also the word that the free software community uses to indict Android, you know, as not a real open source project. And it makes me kind of crazy, I have to tell you. I would like to see these numbers cross-referenced with usage, because I think that Android's usage is probably much higher than a lot of these other products. Let's just say I love Eclipse. It is the IDE that I live in and develop in every single day. It's great. Platform for developers. The thing about openness, I mean, you can define it in so many different ways. As a user, for me, Android being open means I can install whatever I want on my phone. All I can, you know, I don't even have to go through the market. Someone right. can publish an APK and I can say install from untrusted sources and I can install anything I want on my phone. And the pure versions of Android, which don't ship on all devices, but the pure version of Android lets me tether and it lets me fiddle with settings that I normally wouldn't be able to change in other situations. So I know that's a very loose user-centric view of what open is, but I think that, you know, in the end, it's users that really matter. So, you know, these debates about whether or not Android is truly open source and, oh, well, you know, what, look at this, what is this open, Google? It feels tiring to me because open is a marketing term for Google when it comes to Android. And, I mean, it is an open source project, but there are decisions that they've made that make it maybe less pure open than some people, you know, kind of define.
Isn't that the problem? It's the expectation that's been built around it, that it's going to be open and it doesn't meet that definition for a lot of people.
Right. I think that that's really what it is, right? So, I mean, Google touts the operating system as open, and that's its differentiator. And then I think when Android doesn't do exactly what people want it to do, or it's blocked or something's limited, it's like, you know, it's, well, right, you haven't fulfilled your promise.
So maybe what they should do is tout it as closed, and then people will praise it. Look how open this closed operating system is.
Closed operating system is, yeah. I just noticed actually that WebKit is in this list, and WebKit is obviously very heavily used in Chrome and Safari, but packaged up in Chrome and Safari.
All right, we're going to wrap up here in just a few minutes. But before we do, I want to thank NewTek, who provide the TriCaster 850 we're using to switch the show right now. It's like having a giant TV truck, but it's the size of a bread box. Nobody knows how big a bread box is, but it's the size of a desktop PC. It's actually a little smaller than many desktop PCs. 24-channel system with everything you need to make a TV show, including amazing virtual sets. We can use TriCaster for desktop or portable production. We could take one with us out in the field when we go to CES every year. That's how we do it. We get a TriCaster out there, and we've got the ability to do all the switching we do right here in the new studio out on the road with us. Let you live stream, project, and record HD video all at the same time. If you'd like to find out more about TriCaster, head over to the website, newtek.com. That's NEWTEK.com. And big thanks to NewTek for the TriCaster. I know all of the folks running the board here at Twit are incredibly relieved to have all those extra channels, those 24 channels in there. Makes things quite a bit easier. Let's finish off. Google apparently still does a browser. I just got really frustrated with Chrome yesterday, I've been having the little frowny folder face way too often.
Aw, snap.
And I was like, that's it. Firefox has had a couple revs since I was living in it daily. I'm going back. Last night, switched over to Firefox, was using it all morning this morning, and it just doesn't have the snappy UI. For me, it doesn't have, I want to be able to close a tab without clicking on it. I want to be able to move tabs back and forth faster than Firefox can do. I really wanted to switch back to Firefox and I couldn't.
That doesn't bode well. I mean, speed, right? Speed is and still is Chrome's huge selling point. It is quite snappy. Although, were you running the beta chat?
No,
the beta
I'm running the vanilla version? Release, the stable version.
And you're still getting crashed tabs, huh?
Yeah, I was getting tab crashes all... Now, I haven't had one today.
Since you switched back from Firefox?
Yeah.
You know, Tom, what I think crashes it for me? Plus.
Does it? See, yeah. I was suspecting... Now, it's funny you say that. I was suspecting Google Docs.
I don't know that, but that seems to be whenever Plus starts to try to do too much,
mm-hmm.
and it wants to do a huge update because it's trying to constantly update, then what will happen, it starts to drag down my entire Chrome instances, and then I'll snap something a few minutes later.
I don't
know if that's a pattern or not.
I was seeing it with Google Docs tabs.
Mm. Ah, okay.
So maybe there's some Google scripting. Wouldn't surprise me.
You know, the story in the list that Jenny mentioned, speed, that Google Chrome gets instant pages.
Yeah, I was going to say 13 just went stable, right? So the instant pages just got built in.
I got a question about that. What does that do likely to the analytics of the site that receives it? And are advertisers going to have a fit? Does a page preload that you may never look at but still gets counted as a page view and a unique user and an ad display?
from what I understand, and I'm not sure how they're doing it, from what I understand, though, analytics code does not trigger unless the tab comes to the front.
So it does not
mess with views, from what I understand. And I'm not positive how exactly they're doing that, but they are taking into account whether or not you actually look at the page.
Got it. Okay, good.
So this is just a thing that's going to make pages show up faster.
Yeah, they're pre-rendering. Yeah, they not only pre-fetch all the CSS and JavaScript and HTML, but they actually render it. So the JavaScript executes, the CSS lines up the images, all that stuff happens in the background. So when you snap to that tab, the entire page is rendered. Firefox has pre-fetching, which just grabs the files over the wire, but this is pre-rendering. So it's kind of the next step.
Now, did y'all talk about the page speed service last week?
We didn't. That actually got announced, I think, right after our episode.
Okay, because I tried it out. Page speed is actually kind of in the same channel as this. It's trying to make pages faster, but page speed actually wants to make it faster on the site serving end. So you point your DNS at a Google address, and it will speed up the loading of your website. I tried it out with TomMerritt.com. And it definitely speeded it up, not much, a second, but, you know, something, you know, that could make a difference when you're surfing. But the weird thing is the start rendering time slowed down. So when you looked at it, it looked like my old site was loading faster because you got things up faster, even though the actual loading of the entire code was faster with the page speed tool.
Had the DNS maybe not propagate? Was the DNS request having to refresh itself?
Well, now see, I should have mentioned that I didn't do the entire sign up. I compared the load times at the web page test that they provide you. So I may get a different experience when I actually tried it for real.
Right. This is blowing my mind. So basically, Google is hosting the entire internet. I mean, that's what they're offering to do. That they're actually hosting your site, or they're just caching. Are they caching scripts? If you have dynamic scripts on your site, like if you have a PHP script on your site, are they? They
How
must
is
be
that
grabbing the grabbing the output or using their cache copy.
They're reinterpreting the code to optimize it. So what their promise is, they're saying, look, you don't have to write good code anymore. You can be sloppy as all get out. We'll optimize it and fix any errors, and then reserve it. And so we only need to look at it once, and then we'll have it ready to give to folks. In fact, let me see if this. I think my test is still cached. I'm going to see if that. No, the video is. Oh yeah, there it is. All right, yeah. Here, let me start it over again. So check this out. On the left is my original site, and the right is the optimized. And when you start going, now I got to reload the page, don't I? See, because this is what I get for trying to do a demo on the fly from a 6-day-old link. All right, so original on the left, optimized on the right. Now watch. It takes a couple of seconds, and then it looks like the left is faster.
Interesting. It does. But it does. That image came up.
Yeah, because that top image and the first post come up faster, and that's because the start render time is slower. Now, if you noticed, they used to give me that start render time, and in this cached version of the test, it doesn't show that. But then you can also see the page load time difference. The first time was -1 second, so it saved me 1.3 seconds. Repeat view page load time, you think would be faster, but it's actually not that much faster because of the caching that is already done on the browser side, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
But yeah, you can go to. Let's see if I can get back to the.
You have to submit your name and your site to a form.
You go to webpagetest.org, and you just type in your location so that you're getting a fair test. You want to get somewhere that's close to you, and then what browser you want it to test as. Put in your URL. Start the test.
Cool. Very cool.
Yeah. But, getting back to the sort of like, Google is going to be running the internet. Is that a good idea for them to actually, for people to start relying on Google for all of this stuff, for their ads, for their email, for their docs, and now for
come
actually.
Come to the light, children. Yeah. Come to the light.
It's a little scary.
It makes me a little antsy, I'll be honest.
Yeah.
I like hosting my website.
Well, you still host it. That's the brilliance of it. You're still hosting it.
You still host
They're
it.
They're just optimizing it.
Right. They're just optimizing it for me.
They're just.
What's the difference between this and Akamai serving large media sites?
There you go. It's actually not that much. It's kind of CDN-like.
It's like a CDN. Yeah.
All right, we're running short on time. You guys got favorites you want to pick out of what's left here?
I just saw some news just up. This was news to me that Randy Zuckerberg has quit Facebook. Is that news?
News to me too.
Randy Zuckerberg? That's Randy Mark's Zuckerberg. Sister, right?
Mark's sister, right? Yep.
She's starting her own company that's going to advise media companies how to be more social. Now I've just lost the link.
So when you say she's quitting Facebook, she didn't delete her account. She left the company.
Let's she left the company.
Make that clear.
Andy Zuckerberg is starting her own company.
She's
not moving to the new campus, I guess. Randy, who, by the way, is on leave still, I think, because she has a beautiful baby and who she has pictures of on. So she's starting R2Z Media, focusing on helping companies become more social. My goal is to launch my own innovative programming and work with media companies to develop their programming in new and more social ways, she said in her resignation letter, according to Mashable.
And she was the director of marketing. I just read an interview with her earlier this week where she was defending the real names policy of Facebook, but of course Google
Major,
Plus.
She said that she thought anonymity had to go away.
Yeah, she's like, forget anonymity, it's over. I think that's...
It's a little strong.
I understand the impulse to say, you know what, people behave better when there's less anonymity. Using your real name is a good idea. In many of the forums that I've been in charge of at different websites, we've said, look, you know what, you got to have a real account with a real name. It really cuts down on the clutter. But there's that other side of it. There's that dissident whistleblower side of it that you eliminate if you require real names.
Right.
Yep.
Right.
I think this makes a lot of sense for her. I mean, you know, anyone would love to work with her, knowing the ties that she has to Facebook, and you know, clearly she's
a sweetheart. She's really everybody as nice as everybody seems, and every time I've dealt with her, she's just absolutely a dandy to deal with.
Yeah, and good for her for starting her own thing.
Yeah,
I'm surprised she didn't do it sooner. Honestly, yeah. I can't imagine working with your brother for that many years in such a huge, explosive, you know, company, and to have that kind of knowledge, that kind of firsthand knowledge, and not want to do your own thing.
Yeah.
All right. And we got another one of these stories about a school banning teachers from using a social network. In this case, it's Facebook in Missouri.
It's not just a school. It's the entire state.
It's the entire state. It's the state of Missouri. I didn't realize that.
Is passing a law. And there's some finer points to it. But basically, it all but bans teachers from friending students on social networks.
At what levels? Just elementary and high school level?
And you know, and on the one hand, I kind of understand that because it sounds creepy. My own rule, when I teach graduate school, is I won't initiate a friending. If a student of mine wants to friend me, though, I'll do that. You know, we're all adults here. But in this case, it's what Dana Boyd often says is it extends this stranger danger idea to the extreme to make all adults are bad for young people, and that's going too far here. You know, I look at it as the school dance. And if some teachers are on Facebook, I actually like that because it's more eyes on the kids. It's like chaperones.
Mm-hmm.
And now the state has said, no, you adults are all evil and bad to kids. Well, if we think that adults are bad with kids on Facebook, then why are they teaching them in school?
Good point.
Just had to get that out.
Yeah, I mean, it does smack a little bit of fearing the new versus,
absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
Just because do we have a law that bans teachers from calling children on a telephone, you know, or
right.
or stopping by their house? Those sound very creepy in certain circumstances, but we don't need a law against that.
Oh. Right. Now, this should be something that should be determined within the community, a cultural thing within a different each school. I'm sure should kind of come up with their own guidelines, recommendations about this kind of thing. And you know, teachers and staff of schools deal with this all the time. My wife works with undergraduate students, and has to deal with this question of whether or not she should friend. Should she have two accounts, professional account, personal account? Making a law is insane.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's finish up with the tools and the tips and the numbers, and we'll start off with you, Gina. You've got a good way to avoid Airbnb disasters.
Yeah. Google launched a new experiment called Hotel Finder. It's at google.com/hotelfinder. And, you know, you put in a location and dates that you want to stay someplace, and the Hotel Finder returns hotel recommendations. And so this sounds really similar to most, you know, travel kind of search sites, but it's got a couple of neat features. The first thing it does, like I just did a search for Brooklyn, New York. First thing it does is it goes to the area and it creates a shape around the most touristy areas where you're going to get the best hotel deals. So I searched for Brooklyn, but it gave me a good part of Lower Manhattan, which makes sense. So it gives you a list of hotels by price and rating, and you can scan the list and create what they call a short list of hotels that you're interested in possibly booking. So it's a cool little tool for next time you take a trip to check it out and need a place to stay. You can if you click on that edit shape button in the right under the map after you search for a place, it's got this neat heat map of places where tourists typically visit. So that's just cool from a data visualization.
Oh yeah, that is cool.
Yeah, it's really cool.
They all end up in the touristy spots.
Yeah, they all end up in Midtown. Yeah. Apparently. And you can edit the shape. You can increase the bounds or decrease them to narrow down the area where you want to be staying.
They all walk slowly
and look up. Right.
You know, let me give you a tip, rest of the world. In New York, we have things to do. We have places to go. Five of you abreast, like you can do in Kansas, doesn't work here. I love you. I love Kansas. I love the Flyover State, but let us pass you.
Right, and staring up at the skyscrapers gives you away.
Yes,
we exactly. will pick your pockets.
No, I think, Gina, the shorts and the white socks with the sneakers with the backpack and the water bottle and the camera.
Yeah, that does it too.
Yeah.
But their taxes are sure handy, aren't they?
Indeed.
Yeah.
All right. I assume your number is not five abreast. What is your number this week?
My number is 8%, which is the number of Newt Gingrich's followers that are, according to Gawker, actually humans.
Wow.
92% of his 1.3 million followers are fake in one way or another. Now, how that happens exactly, I'm not sure, but I found that number. What interested me even more than that is Peak U, according to Gawker, then did an analysis of the other GOP contenders, and it says that only 20% of Sarah Palin's are real.
Wow.
Mitt Romney's 26%, Michelle Bachmann's 28%, if you consider her real, and Tim Pawlenty, 32%.
Is there an easy way for me to find this? Of my own?
How many of yours are fake?
Yeah.
That's a good point.
There isn't really an easy way. But actually, I'm surprised somebody hasn't made a tool to easily go through. The problem is paging through, you know, a million or even 100,000 followers is kind of hard. And you have to define criteria. What's fake? Someone who's never tweeted, someone who hasn't set a profile picture,
right.
You know, that kind of thing. Someone who's still an egg. But yeah, interesting.
My dogs. Very interesting. My dogs aren't fake, but their Twitter accounts kind of are. All right, I've got an alternate pick just in case, because I'm never sure what tools Leo may have or may have not done. Has he done Reader before? Reader, the app? Yeah.
The iPad app? I don't believe he has. I love that app, though.
No, all right, that's what I'm going to do. Reader, R-E-E. So misspelled, R-E-E-D-E-R, plugs into your Google Reader and gives you what I consider the best interface for Google Reader among any of the interfaces, including the one you actually get on the internet. I use it every morning to just easily start reading my feeds. Allows you to star things. You can post things to Delicious, put them on Twitter, email them to people. You can look at your starred, you know, gives you the three views, your unread items, your starred items, your everything items. And it's just a fantastically well-designed app that I rely on in my daily life. So check it out, R-E-E-D-E-R. I think they only have iPhone, iPad, and Mac. They have a Mac app now. So I'm hoping they come out with other apps for other platforms as well, because they've just done a really fantastic job of designing it. But check it out, R-E-E-D-E-R. All right, well, an unexpected pleasure to be with you guys today.
It was great to have you.
Yeah, thanks, Tom.
And, Hang 'em High, Laporte will be back. I'll be gone next week, but You know, I can't imagine. You know, if I do a crime, I want Leo on my jury. I think he'd be a nice guy.
Yeah, well, you don't.
Be the benefit of the doubt.
Be 11 angry men and Leo cheering them up. You won't get the 12 angry men scenario.
Hopefully Leo won't get put on an 8-week trial and it'll just be me next week.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing that's really bugging him is he's seen people go up and get rejected for being past employees of a major media company and having ever talked to someone on the internet that you didn't know. So he's sitting there going, like, can I just duck out? Can I answer these now?
Oh, that is so frustrating. And also, Mr. have to always be doing or saying or streaming something. I can't imagine what it's like for him.
Exactly.
Sitting in the waiting room.
Thank you again, Gina Trapani, of course, at smarterware.org. Check it out. Try the beta. I have been for a while now. I love it.
Oh, on ThinkUp.
On ThinkUp. Yeah, yeah.
I'm particularly. So glad you're using ThinkUp.
Awesome. I'm still using it. Still loving it.
Right on.
And of course, Jeff Jarvis, BuzzMachine.com. Which book are you on these days?
I am on Public Parts.
I spent
yesterday recording the audiobook, and I'll go back tomorrow. And since you all know how fast I talk, you can imagine how tough that is for me to do a good auto recording.
They're like, we need this to be longer. We need more than one file.
Oh, Jesus. No, the problem is I just muff every paragraph. The poor editor is going to be driven nuts. But I'm getting through it. And yes, people who were nice enough to ask, yes, it will be on Audible. And the book's out in September. And thank you for asking.
Excellent. Excellent. So, thank you both. And thanks to you all for watching or listening. And we will see you. Well, Leo will see you next week if all things go well. That's it for This Week in Google. See you next time.